Disaffinado Discord, the theme music for Literary Discord, the book program of WPKN. Why Discord? Because we want to talk in a different way about books and book publishing. I'm Hans Koning, a novelist, and the producer of my program is Scott Harris. Today we have a different format. With war as the headline in the news, talking about literature seemed somewhat of a luxury. We are having war as a subject today, and poetry as its vehicle. There are two kinds of literature, committed and not committed. In a committed novel, the writer shows an awareness of the human condition. He or she does not think we live in the best of all possible worlds, and may even feel a need to do something about that. Politics, ideology, in the widest sense of those words, does enter into it. In an uncommitted novel, on the other hand, we stay away from all that and sail under the flag of art for art's sake. And that's what our literary establishment, in general, goes for. Walter Goodman wrote in the New York Times that any person who prizes our artistic freedom must stay outside and above the world of politics. An editor of the Atlantic Monthly has been quoted as stating that a black novel could never be literature because by its very nature it had to be political protest writing. There isn't much of a debate on this here, in contrast to Europe and specifically France, where they still manage to get excited about it. In Paris you will hear the opposite of what that Atlantic Monthly man said. In France, serious writing is always protest writing. Anthony Trollope, the 19th century novelist, wrote that a novel must have a message or it isn't worth reading. But this message must be carefully hidden. It must be a, quote, snake in the grass, unquote, for otherwise you don't have a novel but a dissertation or a lecture. There is a field of writing where the message does not have to be smuggled in. To the contrary, it's right up front, a naked snake without any grassy camouflage. That field is of present-day poetry. Political poetry is hardly something new. The Odyssey is political, and so are Blake's dark satanic mills. But the political poetry of our time is an epic. It is bare, unselfconsciously, you could say innocently, factual, and most often angry, closer to rap than to Homer. That is why the poetry is so effective. A single line may strike us more than many pages of prose, and such lines may stay in our memory and reappear quite unexpectedly. Here are lines from the Russian Konstantin Simonov. They are from Wait for Me, which he wrote in 1941 when the German army was approaching Moscow in Steps of Calamity, as Boris Pasternak wrote. Wait for me and I will return, only wait very hard. Wait when you are filled with sorrow as you watch the yellow rain. They will not understand that in the midst of death you with your waiting saved me. Only you and I will know how I survived. It is because you waited, as no one else did. Here is another commitment, a mysteriously irrational one, not mourning the lonely tragedy of war, but finding an answer to it. This became the best-known poem ever written in Russia. People recited it all that year, 1941, as if it were a prayer. It was a prayer. There's nothing singular about the new role of committed poetry. We have for a long time now, perhaps ever since 1914, wander towards an unmeasured future. We have lost our confidence in black-white solutions. We have to go to new places for making decisions, places where poetry is at home. Today we have an actress, poet here, Kate Finley, and she is going to read some poems about war, obviously against war, of some of the best-known American poets and also one of herself. Here's Kate Finley.
Thank you, Hans. This is a poem by Denise Levertov called From the Image Flow, Summer of 1986. These days, these years, when powers and principalities of death weigh down the world deeper and deeper than we ever thought it could fall and still keep slowly spinning, hope, caught under the jar's rim, crawls like a golden fly around and around, a sentinel. It can't get out. It can't fly free among our heavy hearts. But it does not die, keeps up its pace, pausing only as if to meditate a saving strategy. And this is a poem by Nina Bogan called The Sleepers. The torturers sleep or do not sleep, dreaming of brightly lit corridors that kept them awake. The houses are eyes squeezed shut. Flowers waste their perfumes overnight. The others, in sleep, climb interminable flights of stairs toward the window which opens onto the roof. It is dawn, and the tiles gleam with dew. Clothes on lines fan the air like wings. There in the violet bay glides the boat that will take them to a neighboring country. There is the suitcase with the false papers and few belongings, the rope ladder, the gloves, the helping friends. Hands ease them down the swaying rungs, guide them on hushed tires through the city, quiet as a beating heart. The quay smells of promise and salt. Now the anchor lifts, the sails fill with shadow, the prow heads north or south or east or west, and the boat rocks, rocking the sleepers into the night, sealed up like a letter, unsent. And this is by E.E. Cummings, written in, I think, the 1920s. Next to, of course, God, America, I love you, land of the pilgrims, and so forth. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early? My country, 'tis of centuries, come and go, and are no more. And what of it? Should we worry in every language, even deaf and dumb? Thy sons acclaim your glorious name, by gory, by jingo, by gee, by gosh, by gum. Why talk of beauty? What could be more beautiful than these heroic, happy dead who rushed like lions to the roaring slaughter? They did not stop to think. They died instead. Then shall the voice of liberty be mute? He spoke and drank rapidly a glass of water. And this is a poem by Charles Simic called Paradise Motel. Millions are dead. Everybody was innocent. I stayed in my room. The president spoke of war as of a magic love potion. My eyes were opened in astonishment. In a mirror, my face appeared to me like a twice-canceled postage stamp. I lived well, but life was awful. There were so many soldiers that day, so many refugees crowding the roads. Naturally, they all vanished with a touch of the hand. History licked the corners of its bloody mouth. On the pay channel, a man and a woman were trading hungry kisses and tearing off each other's clothes while I looked on, with the sound off and the room dark, except for the screen, where the color had too much red in it, too much pink. And this is a poem by me called August. Pride of man, our God is male. Claiming the same God, following the word, wielding the terrible swift sword, rendering lifeless all that is good among us. Where is our collective bravery to confront these myths? We have all we need but understanding of the unreasoning seed that goes beyond discontent. These are our middle ages. We've seduced the executioner, brought our own demise, suffered our own tortures, eclipsed our best hour, approached the dark side of the moon. Progress? Destiny? What? And this is a poem called City of Orphans by John Haynes. How strange to think of those streets and vacant lots, the sandhills where we played and dug our trenches, the forts we built, the enemies we conjured to aim our stick guns at, and then we went home at evening, to victory, to safety, and to sleep. And now the vast acres of rubble and pitched, roofless houses, upended stonework and sunken bridges, the dog packs roaming, digging for the one still unclaimed victim, the stray sniper aiming at dusk, and in the roadside fields, flowers that explode when picked. The children wandering from one burned suburb to another, seeking that which no longer exists, a neighborhood, a playing field, a wading pool or a standing swing, a kite to fly, a ball to throw, or just one pigeon to stone. And through all this haunted vacancy, from cellars and pits of sand, come and go as on a fitful wind such whispers, taunts, and pleadings, the scolding voices of dead parents, the lessons of teachers no longer standing, whose classrooms are blown to ash and smoky air. And far off, unheard beyond the drone of a single hovering aircraft, in Paris, Zurich, Prague, or London, the murmur of convening statesmen. This is another poem by John Haynes, The Last Election. Suppose there are no returns, and the candidates, one by one, drop off in the polls as the voters turn away, each to his inner persuasion. The front runners, the dark horses, begin to look elsewhere, and even the president admits he has nothing new to say. It is best to be silent now. No more conventions, no donors, no more hats in the ring, no ghost-written speeches, no promises we always knew were never meant to be kept. And something like the truth, or what we knew by that name, that for which no corporate sponsor was ever offered, takes hold in the public mind. Each subdued and thoughtful citizen closes his door, turns off the news, opens the book, quietly speaks to his children, and begins to live once more. And this is by Robinson Jeffers, Shine, Perishing Republic. While this America settles in the mold of its vulgarity, heavily thickening to empire and protest, only a bubble in the molten mast pops and sighs out, and the mass hardens. I sadly, smiling, remember that the flower fades to make fruit, the fruit rots to make earth. Out of the mother and through the spring, exultances, ripeness and decadence, and home to the mother. You making haste, haste on decay, not blameworthy, life is good, be it stubbornly long or suddenly a mortal splendor. Meteors are not needed less than mountains. Shine, perishing republic. But for my children, I would have them keep their distance from the thickening center. Corruption never has been compulsory. When the cities lie at the monster's feet, there are left the mountains. And boys be in nothing so moderate as in love of man, a clever servant, insufferable master. There's the trap that catches noblest spirits, that caught, they say, God, when he walked on earth. And this is by Carolyn Kaiser, called The Gulf War, which was the first Gulf War. The whole green sky is dying. The last tree flares, with a great burst of supernatural rose under a canopy of poisonous air. Could we imagine our return to prayers, to end in time before time's final throes? The green sky is dying as the last tree flares. But we were young in judgment, old in years. Who could make peace? But it was war we chose to spread its canopy of poisoning air. Not all our children's pleas and women's fears could steer us from this hell, and now God knows his whole green sky is dying as it flares. Our crops of wheat have turned to fields of tares. This dreadful century staggered to its close, and the sky dies for us, its poisoned airs. All rain was dust, its granules were out of tears. Throats burst as universal winter rose to kill the whole green sky, the last tree bare beneath its canopy of poisoned air. And this is by Sigrid Sassoon, 1918. If I were fierce and bold and short of breath, I'd live with scarlet majors at the base, and speed glum heroes up the line to death. You'd see me with my puffy, petulant face, guzzling and gulping in the best hotel, and reading the Roll of Honor. Poor young chap, I'd say. I used to know his father well. Yes, we've lost heavily in this last scrap. And when the war is done, and youth stone dead, I'd toddle safely home and die in bed. And this is by Carol Muskie Dukes, called The House of Bush. This is the house of madness. This is the man who sits in the house of madness. This is the time of the man named Bush who sits in the house of madness. This is a time bomb ticking away in the time of the man named Bush who sits in the house of madness. This is the child strapped to the bomb ticking away the time of the man named Bush who sits in the house of madness. This is the ravaged land of the child strapped to the bomb ticking away the time of the man named Bush who sits in the house of madness. These are the years and the cries of loss, the starving poor, the reeling stocks, the chanting young, the face of the child strapped to the bomb, ticking away the time of the man named Bush who sits in the house of madness. These are the oil wells pumping dry, the corporate lies, the Enron ties, the reeling stocks, the jobless lines, the face of the child strapped to the bomb, ticking away by a cyclone fence with a nickel bag in our hometown, in the time of the man named Bush who sits in the house of madness. These are the oil wells across the sea, the dictator's deal, the torturer's cage, the affairs of state in the ravaged land of the child strapped to the bomb, ticking away in the time of the man named Bush, who sits alone in the all-white house of madness. And this is by Robert Bly, Call and Answer. Tell me why it is we don't lift our voices these days and cry over what is happening. Have you noticed the plans are made for Iraq and the ice cap is melting? I say to myself, go on, cry. What's the sense of being an adult and having no voice? Cry out. See who will answer. This is call and answer. We will have to call especially loud to reach our angels, who are hard of hearing. They are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. Have we agreed to so many wars that we can't escape from silence? If we don't lift our voices, we allow others who are ourselves to rob the house. How come we've listened to the great criers, Neruda, Akhmatova, Thoreau, Frederick Douglass, and now we're as silent as sparrows in the little bushes? Some masters say our life lasts only 7 days. Where are we in the week? Is it Thursday yet? Hurry! Cry now! Soon Sunday night will come. And this I took off the internet in the Huffington Post, I think, by Larry Gelbart, who was the creator of the series MASH. Waking up is hard to do. Waking up is hard to do. It's so much harder than it used to be. It's so hard to start the day gagging on the body count before breakfast. So hard looking into the bathroom mirror, still trying to absorb the sight of so many lifeless bodies on the tube at the foot of my bed. Brush my teeth? After seeing the sight of so many who died while I slept? Young men, mothers, five-year-olds, infants who will never get that far. Waking up, I delay for as long as I can, pressing the remote. I resist having as my first view of yet another day what has become television's test pattern for the 21st century, a bunch of somebody's good guys slaughtering a bunch of somebody else's good guys. And my guides and usherettes through all the carnage that the cable chews on so voraciously, urban anchormen in their L.L. Beans, simultaneously reporting and upstaging file and vile footage of the Red Cross, the Red Crescent, and all the red blood that threatens to soil my bedspread. It gets harder and harder waking up to learn what new leakings have revealed which of our lawmakers have been discovered breaking even more laws. Harder and harder to restart the daily cycle of frustration, of fear and anger, anger at those who never stop lying about how they've made the world a safer, less fearful place. harder to shut out the noise of crashing pensions and the steady drumbeat of corporate criminality, harder and harder to accept being humped at the pump, harder and harder to endure one single day more of the three R's, Rove, Rice, Rumsfeld. If you need another R, Richard is what our vice president was called before he chose to become a dick. That's a cheap shot. Less troublesome than a bad one. One who aims at a duck and hits a human being. One who aims at Afghanistan and maims the whole of Iraq. Hard waking up hoping. If we are lucky, maybe some of us will be remembered as the good Germans at this nadir in the history of the late, great United States. One nation under God? Excuse me? God sanctions torture? God smiles down on signing statements? Thou shalt not kill? Wink, wink. When asked what he considered the secret to happiness, Tennessee Williams replied, "Insensitivity, I guess." By that standard, this White House has to be the happiest administration ever. If I thought any of those scumbags had an ounce of pity stowed away under their irremediably falsely optimistic hearts, I would get down on my knees and beg them to give me back just a tenth of my former peace of mind. I would implore them to give me back my mornings. If they'd just give me that, I'll take responsibility for the rest of the day. And this is called Blue Jay, written by John Smith of Frenchtown, New Jersey, an English teacher, after the beginning of this Iraq war. I hadn't thought about the sky until a bird snapped against the half-open window of my first car, and a puff of feathers flushed up in the rearview mirror. When they settled, there was a blue jay laid out, in its only uniform, on the back window ledge. I was just about draft age, headed for my girlfriend's house with one hand on the wheel, the other dialing past the latest body count on the radio, looking for doors or stones. I hadn't thought about the sky. I barely had my eyes on the road. And this is a song by Charles Aznavour, a French singer, about his home country, Armenia. Ils sont tombés. Ils sont tombés pudiquement sans bruit, par milliers, par millions, sans que le monde bouge, devenant un instant minuscule fleur rouge, recouvert par un vent de sable et puis oubli. They fell modestly and delicately, in the thousands, in the millions, without the world moving. In one instant, they became a minuscule red flower, and then they were covered again by a windy sand, and then forgotten. And this is called The Human Heart, by Campbell McGrath. We construct it from tin and ambergris and clay, ochre, graph paper, a funnel of ghosts, whirlpool in a downspout full of midsummer rain. It is, for all its freedom and obstinance, an artifact of human agency, in its maverick intricacy, its chaos reflected in earthly circumstance. Its appetites mirrored by a hungry world like the lights of a casino in the coyote's eye, old as the odor of almonds in the hills around Solano. Filigreed and chanceled with flavor of blood orange, fashioned from moonlight, yarn, nacre, cordite, shaped and assembled valve by valve, flange by flange, and finished with the carnal fire of interstellar dust. We build the human heart and lock it in its chest and hope that what we have made can save us. I'm going to read a quote by Helen Keller as a sort of antidote to all the fear-mongering going on. Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. To keep our faces toward change and behave like free spirits in the presence of fate is strength undefeatable. And this was from a woman who could neither hear nor see. And last, I'd like to read a quote by Howard Zinn. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents. And to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory. Thank you.
You have listened to Literary Discord, the book program of WPKN 89.5 FM. I am Hans Koning, a writer. Our guest, reader of the war poetry, was Kate Finley. Our producer is Scott Harris, activist. Literary Discord is broadcast on the fourth Thursday of the month at 12 noon, and the program is repeated on the second Tuesday of the following month at 9:30 in the evening. Thank you for listening.